This is I Will Rule For You, a The Hobbit fanfic, written by Sospace and read by Rena Jenkins. The story is PG-13 and takes place post-Battle of Five Armies, with major canonical character death, grief, and violence.
On the dark roads of this strange land, every eye stares, every mouth is open. From the homeless days to the heartless nights, when the hunger bites, every door is closed.
Dees knows what's happened the moment she sees the look in Balin's eyes. Word came to Ered Luin over a month ago, in the shape of a jet-black raven with her brother's name on its beak. And they've been marching ever since. To so many, Erebor had become just another dream, like Mithril or a decent beard before 100. And Thorin's quest was nothing but foolishness to so many of their kind. But the moment that raven came, all tired wings and bright, intelligent eyes, Durin's folk rallied. The march was hard, pushing on long after the light had faded. But dwarves are hardy folk, and all the talk on anyone's lips had been the king under the mountain. They marched for a king they loved, and a wealth they had missed so very much. But most of all, they were marching for home, for a place they'd never thought they'd see again, for happiness and for hope. One evening, with the campfires low and the ponies asleep, Dees felt something, almost like a blow to her stomach. She had done little more than hiss in a startled breath, but hundreds of leagues away, her family was bloody on a battlefield, her sons giving their lives for her brother dying to protect their bodies. While they march, she thinks little of it. A ghost in the night, nothing more. Now she crosses the plain before Erebor's gates, mud churning at her feet, and Balin takes her by the hand and says, "My lady, I am so sorry." Breath shudders from Dees' lips, because her sons are nowhere to be seen. She thinks of that pain in her stomach, in her heart, all that time ago. And she knows. For a moment she wants to scream, to cry, to rend her hair and do everything that is a grieving mother's right. Is Erebor worth this? Worth the loss of the boy she carried within herself for so long? But the moment passes. She is so very still. And the mountain rears overhead, dark and brooding and greedy. She is Durin's future now. Dees takes a breath, steadies the shaking of her hands. Inside she is broken, but her voice is calm when she says, "Take me to them." The catacombs under Erebor's lowest depths are cool and dry, lit by guttering torches in sconces along the walls. Her ancestors line the way, tombs carved with runes no one now understands, reverently crafted sculptures reclining atop each one. In death, her forebears are far more peaceful than they ever were in life. Dees touches a hand to where Durin sleeps, and the stone is icy cold to her touch. His features are worn now. She passes by. When they reach her brother's tomb, tunnels still stretch on into the distance, dark and empty. One day she will lie there too, as she stops beside Lauren, lets out a soft breath. There has been no time yet to give him the effigy he deserves, and she smooths her hand across the stone casket, says, "Brother." "The Arkenstone is buried with him," Balin says quietly. Dees is almost thankful. The stone was beautiful, yes, but she remembers her newborn sons, naked and filthy and squalling. There is nothing more beautiful than that. "Was it worth it?" she silently asks. But Thorin gives no answer. She smiles a sad smile and doesn't let the tears fall. "Goodbye," she says. Balin leads her away. The main chamber is reserved for Erebor's kings, however briefly they reigned. But there is a warren of winding side tunnels devoted to the line of Durin in all its permutations. There are no effigies here, merely names and dates. Bastard sons are buried here, along with honored wives, stillborn children alongside the oldest of the old. And her sons lie among them, in a corner all of their own, two tombs so close together they almost appear as one. Dees' breath hiccups in her throat, and Balin says, "We buried them together. It seemed right." Dees thinks of Feely's smile and Keely's laugh, and the way they would finish each other's sentences and cover up each other's childhood misdeeds with that gleeful innocence of youth. "They would have wanted that," she says. They loved each other, she knows, as more than brothers should. But she loved them for it. To see them happy was enough, because with the mountain lost and the dragon snarling in the back of every nightmare, happiness was a rare and precious thing. She touches her fingertips to the cold stone, whispers, "My sweet boys." Behind her, Balin bows his head. There is nothing Dees wants to do more in that moment than curl up beside her lost sons and sleep with them. There's an emptiness in her heart, a fundamental absence, and with the shadows dark around her and no one but Balin to see, she closes her eyes, feels tears drip from her chin. Her heart beats slow and steady, almost mockingly so. She doesn't know how to go on, but she knows that she has to, because she led their people here from Eren Luin, from a place they had made their home. And with Thorin and his heirs gone, it's her responsibility to see them safe. Dees breathes out, opens her eyes. "You are loved," she says to her sons. "Forever. Remember that." She turns away. Balin's eyes are dark. Erebor's halls are full of dragon stink, that bitter, hot smell that clings to every crevice and can be scrubbed away by nothing but time. But these are the halls that Dees grew up in, that she knows better than she knows herself. She goes to the throne room, sees nothing but a gaping hole where her grandfather's throne used to sit. Smaug tore it away, crunched it tiny, and gulped down the pieces with a fiery belch. Many of the smaller chambers are ruined, smashed open by the dragon's flailing, blackened and burned by his fire. But there are those that survived. In an antechamber where Thorin's company must have made their camp, Dees finds a knife lying forgotten in a corner, slender blade gleaming in the firelight. She recognizes it as Feely's the moment she sees it, and she picks it up, tucks it away next to her heart, doesn't let her heart show. That knife toppled quietly from its sheath some time ago, forgotten in Feely's excitement for battle and glory and his joy at the fire in his brother's eyes. He went out without it, and when he was on his knees over his brother's body with the enemy closing in, it could have saved his life. Dees doesn't know. Dees doesn't need to know. She keeps that blade and hides it away with their childhood toys and the clasps Balin took from their hair to place in her hair, still dipped in their blood. She meets Dwalin and Dane at the front gate. She sees the words of sorrow and grief and regret forming on their lips, and she holds up a hand, forestalls their condolences. "We will rebuild," she says. "We'll start with the living quarters. The rooms are burnt, but mostly still intact. Once we can live here again, we'll see what can be done about the forges." There's a sudden light in Dwalin's eyes. Dane doesn't smile, but he folds his arms, and there is satisfaction in the set of his shoulders. These are her people, and she has lost everything. She will not lose them. "And get me the Elven King," she continues, stronger. "He failed my brother. He owes us his allegiance." She doesn't go to marvel at Smaug's hoard, at the accumulated wealth of her people piled high at the heart of the kingdom she never wanted to inherit. She remembers how Thorin held her close on the first nights of exile, the mountain still looming behind them, how safe she felt, and she stays away. It takes them another month to scrub the living quarters into something vaguely resembling habitation, and for all that time, Dees sleeps among her people, sprawled across Erebor's entrance hall, sheltering from the winds of winter that howl outside. She holds the hands of the young, boosts the spirits of the old, and the healthy put themselves at her command. She works with them, wiping away the memory of the dragon, the memory of their grief. And she thinks of her sons and her brother every moment of every day. Remembers Keely crawling in the grass, Thorin teaching them both to fight. They rebuild. The forges resound with hammering, and the stones are quarried to rebuild the throne room that Smaug defiled. The Elven King comes with tools and supplies and a squad of Elven volunteers who throw themselves into the building work with all the gusto of the guilty. Thranduil doesn't apologize as such, doesn't throw himself on Dees' mercy for imprisoning her family. But he looks at her with the weight of fatherhood in his eyes and says, "I grieve for your loss." "Ely," Dees thinks. "Keely." "Thank you," she says, and feels so small on her fresh-hewn throne. The elves of the Greenwood are the first to pledge allegiance, and Bard's men are right behind them. They bring gifts and promises, and lend all that they can to the rebuilding. And Dees watches as her Erebor rises from the dragon's ashes. Balin stands at her right shoulder, Dwalin her left, and Dane writes to her every other day, letters full of, "Our people are mighty once more," and "We are with you." When the front gate stands impenetrable once more, they have a feast. Tables groan with the weight of food, and her people drink and make merry and forget the troubles that have dogged them for so long. Dees smiles along with them, but drinks her ale slowly, eats calmly, thinks about braiding her young son's hair, and leading her brother on a merry chase through these very halls when they were dwarflings. She doesn't cry. She hasn't cried since she last told her children they were loved. Dwalin stands, pounds on the table for silence.
A toast,
he roars into the hall.
To the Queen under the mountain, who has made us a home to be proud of once more. Queen Dis!
A thousand dwarves echo his words in raucous uproar, and Dis cannot help but smile. That night, when all the mountain is quiet, or in a drunken stupor, she goes alone to the catacombs, stands beside her brother, and traces the lines of his newly chiseled face. Biffer did the carving, pouring weeks of his life into this memory, and it is so real it hurts Dee's heart. She kisses his cheek, softly says, "You would be so proud. Erebor is more than we ever dreamed." She pauses, smiles sadly. "I miss you, brother." Thorin doesn't answer. He's never expected anything else. She moves on, follows the winding tunnels, goes to her sons. The shadows are heavy around the weak torch she holds aloft. Her footsteps are heavy and regular on the smooth stone floor. And when she sees her sons, sees the blankness of those impenetrable stone tombs, she stops dead, hands trembling, lips agape. And then she rages, hurls the torch from her hand to spark against the far wall, hammers her bare fists against the walls, the floors, her children's tombs, screams only a mother can. And she shatters her finger bones and splits her skin, but she is so far from caring, it's almost laughable. She's only now realizing that the emptiness in her heart isn't empty at all. It's full of anger and rage and vitriol. Because her sons died for a mountain and a heap of treasure, and she is left behind and they are gone. She roars, and the catacomb sends back mocking echoes. After a while, she comes back to herself. She's collapsed against their tombs, hands bloody, throat raggedly hoarse, and her torch has gone out. The darkness claims her, alleviated only faintly by the eternal glow from the main chambers. Her children are still dead. Slowly, Dis gets to her feet. Her bones ache, and she is so tired. She lays her right hand on Kili's tomb, her left on Fili's, and says, low and soft and full of pain, "I will rule for you." She rules, and she is mighty. The end.
Give me one hand to reach for a vision. Give me one voice, I will make it sing. Give me one heart. Oh,